Hi, I'm Wendy Zuckerman and you're listening to Science Versus. And today we have something really special for you. So recently I flew to LA to be interviewed by Emma Chamberlain. She's a YouTuber. She has her own podcast. It's called Anything Goes. And Emma has been described by a friend of mine as Gandhi for 21-year-olds. I was very excited to meet with her. But I have to say that when I arrived in LA, I was quite jet lagged. And just between us, I might have had a cheeky nap in the green room. But then I met Emma and we just got along like a house on fire. And we had this really, really fun chat. We talked about the science of vaping and alcohol, ketamine and orgasms. We talked a lot about orgasms. And I just had so much fun that I wanted to share this interview with you. We also talked about the time that I was accused of being a pyromaniac and was almost kicked out of uni for it. So I hope you enjoy that this interview. This is what we're going to play for you today. And if you are listening to this on Spotify, you can also watch this interview. That's right. This is on video. You might be looking at me right now. Hello. If you're listening on another app, just enjoy beautiful audio. All right. This is Emma Chamberlain interviewing me for her podcast, Anything Goes. Hope you enjoy.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
If you ever wanted to meet the nerds behind the science soundbites, I've got the podcast for you and it's called Ologies. It's hosted by the very fabulous Ali Ward and each week she looks at a different ology. She's covered etymology and cosmology, but also lemurology, which is about lemurs, and neuroparasitology, which is about parasites that attack the brain. Ologies is fun and tells these juicy science stories. I think you're going to love it. So check out Ologies with Ali Ward wherever you get your podcasts.
Were you a science kid in school? Because I was.
Oh, I was not.
Really?
I mean, like, you know how, like, you backpedal your life story? Mm-hmm. And you're like, I was meant to be a science journalist. Or mm-hmm. And there is, I did find, because now I live in Melbourne, like, back in my hometown. And I did find a book that I wrote when I was, like, in year two or something that was, like, how plaque forms.
Oh.
And it was, like, basically what I'm doing now. Like, yeah. It was, like, you know, the little bacteria live on your teeth. And I was, like, look, I was destined to be. But the truth is, like, I wasn't really that interested in science at all. I guess I was, like, more of a drama kid.
That's so funny. So you were not into science. But were you, like, naturally maybe curious?
Not even. I mean, I studied it so, like, finished high school and was like, I get, you know, like, I don't want to get a job yet. So I you know, I got to go to college and then was like, curing cancer is a thing that, yeah, like, that seems great, yep, in the world. So that's why I studied biomedical science. And it was just, mm-hmm, and then was really bad. I'm a nerd in that I want to get good grades. So I was like studying really hard, just rote learning stuff, didn't really understand anything. In like my second year of uni, I had the Bunsen burner. Like, I was terrible in lab.
Yeah.
Had the Bunsen burner on too high and melted some equipment. It was so bad that I almost got kicked out of uni because they were like, you must be incompetent. Like, you, no, they didn't believe I could be. So they were like, you must be a pyromaniac.
What?
And I managed to convince him. I was like, no, I didn't do it on purpose. I swear.
Whoa.
I just did it anyway. And then I walked out of that meeting and was like, okay, clearly I'm not going to be a scientist.
Okay.
But then somewhere along the way, like, realized that what I love is science stories. Is like, there's so much, like, fun stories of discovery to mm-hmm. be found in science.
Yep.
It's like how we know how the world works. It's how we know, like, why you should go on one diet and not the other.
Yes.
Like, it's how, like, why, whether jumping into, like, ice water makes you feel better. Like, it's,
yes,
it's how we know anything.
Yes.
And so that was fun. That was fun to, like, talk to scientists and explain things. And I think because I was so bad at it, it helps me explain because it wasn't intuitive when I was starting out, you know.
Yes.
People would say complicated science things and I'd be like, I don't understand. Please say it again.
See, that is such a perfect niche for you. It's like you are curious about all of it. You love it. your job is then translating it into human.
Yeah.
It's a totally different skill to translate it to human. And that's kind of what you do.
That's what I think, like, because I had these, like, my parents who were both academics, funnily enough. So mm-hmm. I guess that must have been another thing in the mix. They always telling me, like, if you don't understand something, mm-hmm. just, like, ask more questions. Don't ever feel stupid for not understanding something. It's, mm-hmm. If someone's trying to teach you something and you don't understand it, you just keep asking questions. And so I think that really helps. It's like if a scientist is just using these complicated words. I mean, by now I've been in the game for so long.
Yeah.
I can speak the language.
Yes.
But when I was starting out, there was just a lot of, okay, so what was that? What do you mean?
Yes.
Any analogies you can help me out with?
Yes.
Know? So it's been fun to like marry the two worlds. Yeah.
Now your specialty is translating things to human and sort of sorting through all the different sort of scientific misconceptions. I think because the scientific language is so complex, it can be misunderstood so easily, which is why your voice is so important, but also so exciting for people because it's like, now I get it. Like, now I get it.
Right.
I understand. Because it's like, there's always so many conflicting ideas. And ultimately, you know, I think science is relevant for everybody because it's like, we all use it to figure out how to have a better life. It's so important. But if you Google something, you're going to find 90 different results.
Yes. There's so much garbage. And what's funny is like, when I started Science Versus, the world of like bullshit online was just starting. I mean, I guess that's what I was seeing. And I was like, oh, I should make a podcast where we're like looking at things in the zeitgeist mm-hmm. and really examining them and like really, you know, reading the scientific papers because we don't want to be regurgitating more of the misinformation. Like we're down there reading the scientific papers, then translating them.
Yep.
But when I started Science Versus, I was like, we've got 4 seasons in us. You know, like once we tackle like yes, climate change exists, you know, yes, vaccines like, you know, are good for you and you know, we need to be taking them despite, you know, minor risks here and there. You know, once you hit the top, I was like, all right, this show's gonna be
right,
done.
Right.
But the internet has just kept minting bullshit. Like it's like as if it was just coming for me.
No, it's never ending.
It's never the like more and more diets every year. There's fasting.
Oh, yeah.
There's keto.
Yep.
There was now like last season I did like seed oils. I was like, where is like now we're not allowed to eat seed oil.
Yes.
What? Where did this come from?
Yep.
And I was like, thank you.
No,
internet.
It's amazing. Like, the thing is that humans love, and you've probably noticed this over the years, we like to find a Band-Aid. We want to find a Band-Aid for things.
Yes.
We want to find an explanation. And honestly, I'm somebody who is somewhat, I'd like to say that I'm not, but I am somewhat, we all are susceptible to these, you know, big claims.
Well, we want an answer. When something's wrong with our health, mm-hmm. when we know we're not functioning in the way that we used to, like mm-hmm. whether like our brain's feeling foggy or like tummy's not feeling right.
Mm-hmm.
We're like, what could it be? What mm-hmm. could it be? And you know, going to doctors, like I'm all about the like healthcare system and mm-hmm. go to your doctor, but like they can be assholes and they cannot listen to you.
Totally.
And so at the same time as we're seeing, you know, this sort of rise of misinformation online, there's also a greater appreciation that like, yeah, you go to your doctor, if you don't have a GP that you like,
mm-hmm.
they might just be like, it's all in your head.
Yep.
Live with it. Is it really that bad?
Yep.
Like, take some medication that has nasty side effects. And so it doesn't surprise me that people are then going online,
mm-hmm.
finding like influencers, like people that they like are giving them other solutions mm-hmm. and then running with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally get the situation that we're in.
Yeah.
But it just does mean that I think a lot of vulnerable people who are searching for solutions, who don't have like the doctor, the medical care that they need, I think they are getting trapped in this world where they're like buying supplements they don't need, going on diets they don't need to go on, like, and so that's why it feels good to make the show to be like, well, look, here's what might be going on, here's mm-hmm. what maybe you don't need to be buying this, maybe jumping in ice cold water will be helpful, you know.
Yep.
So I get it. So I think like as I've been making the show, I've been way more empathetic to all of us who are just, you know, I think maybe when I was starting, I came in from like a real like on high of like, I'll read the science and tell you what the answer is. But now I'm like, I get it. It's really, really hard out there.
Yep.
And so we're just like trying to put good information out there.
What do you think is the reason for so much misinformation? Like I, you know, when I think about it, one reason could be like there's a company benefiting from misinformation, possibly. Like that's maybe one source.
Or a person.
Or a person. Do you think it's more nowadays influencers and sort of uneducated individuals or like, you know, individuals who lack the credential to be spreading information? Do you think it's those sort of people who kind of want to provide an answer to, you know, maybe build a following and so people will sort of trust them and like look to them for answers? Or do you think it's more like corporations that are interested in spreading misinformation? Or do you think it's a combination?
Oh, interesting. Look, the ones that like that really piss me off, like I don't know when we look at like the big problem of misinformation online. I generally I think it's individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Like corporations have all like we always know, like, we know capitalism exists.
Yep.
They're there to spread a message of propaganda. I feel like people know, people have in their heads. Like, if you see a Shell ad for, like, we're interested in renewables, everyone's head is like,
yes.
Fuck off now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everyone's like, I don't,
it's like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for your contribution to climate change.
Totally.
Appreciate it. Like, I understand the, like.
We understand the language. We, like, see through maybe a corporation.
Exactly. But with individuals, that's where I see people really getting sucked in. And so, and, you know, sometimes you have these like really, I don't want to name any names, but you know, in the wellness influencer sector, there are some really big names who kind of use, what I see is they use our mistrust of corporations.
Yes.
To then like
yes.
twist things on their head. So a story that I hear over and over again is like, you can't trust Big Pharma. You can't even trust science. They're all in it for the money. Instead, what you need are natural supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who sells them? Me.
And guess who has a code? And guess, yeah.
And you're like, they're like, follow the money, man. Follow the money. Like, you can't trust pharma. And it's like, I'll follow the money right to your damn pocket.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just this story. And I'm like, how are people getting sucked into this? But it's, but I know why. It's this thing that like sometimes science calls the guru effect,
mm-hmm.
where you have these guru, they have this like, which you've talked about on the show, this parasocial relationship where they feel like, you know, oh, it's my friend. I can trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you're buying these supplements when it's like these are unproven.
Yeah.
You are putting money right into their pockets.
Exactly.
And at the same time shitting on science. I'm like, excuse me.
Well, that's the thing that's so annoying about it, I think, too, especially is the blatant and so obvious hypocrisy. It's like right there. It's like, babe, it's unbelievable, but I also, it's such a perfect business model, despite it being evil. It's genius because it's the perfect manipulation because it's playing into like, well, I'm a small business and I'm, you know, and I'm an individual and I've healed my issues through this, you know, turmeric supplement.
Yeah.
If you say like, oh, you know, you can cure this, this and that using this, you know, supplement that obviously doesn't work.
Yes.
Like there's no science to show that it works.
It's potentially very, particularly if you're not saying things like, you need to make sure you take like traditional, like conventional medicines too.
Yeah.
You know, you can, so that really pisses me off. And then the other thing that I see a lot of, because you were sort of mentioning like, is it influencers who maybe are uneducated? But actually, I see a lot of people who have like MD wearing their scrubs out there on TikTok talking bullshit. And I'm like, that really pisses me off because they're clearly using their healthcare education, like whether it's their RNs or whatever it is, they're using that and they know they're using that to get people to think, oh, I can trust them. They've got their scrubs on. They probably came out from seeing a patient or something.
Yeah.
And if you're wearing your scrubs or you're like a doctor, you know, you need to be really careful about your facts. And so often I'm like, because part of the show is like looking for like, what's the internet saying about a particular thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll see these like doctors saying stuff and then we fact check it with experts in the field and I'm reading the papers and I'm like, that's not real. So this is like what we're fighting against. I'm like, if you are about to go on a show like this with an audience, take some responsibility, get your facts right.
So let's play devil's advocate then.
Love it.
We're all human, right? Including the experts, including, you know, the people writing, you know, the most advanced, the most modern, you know, the most accurate scientific papers.
Yeah.
Can we really trust anything for sure, in your opinion?
No, great. It's a great question. So here's my pitch for why I love science.
I do too.
Why
yes.
I think we can trust science. So at its best, science is just testing all these theories we have, whatever it is. Like, will this skincare product reduce wrinkles? Will ketamine, like, cure depression?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you can say that, or even you can have had an amazing experience, or you and your friends can have had amazing experiences,
mm-hmm.
and you can tell people about it. But you'll never know, like, oh, like, does this actually work? Or yep. was it, you know, I took ketamine, I felt great for a month or whatever. Like, was it something else that happened that night?
Yep,
was it,
yep.
you know, were you actually moving to, like, was it starting to be a good place in your life and then you felt great? Like,
yep.
so the only way you could actually know, was it the ketamine that caused it and, mm-hmm. like, that caused this benefit? Let's stick with our ketamine example.
Yep.
Like, is to actually do a study where not only do you take, like, let's say 100 people
mm-hmm.
and give who have depression and give some of them ketamine, you also need to give some of them a placebo
mm-hmm.
because the placebo effect is so powerful.
So powerful.
It's so – and, like, yeah. I know sometimes people hear that and they're like, oh, it's all in your head. It's like – but, no, it should be something that we can all harness. Like, mm-hmm. it is wonderful that the placebo effect
– it's amazing.
Is amazing. Like, that we can – cure ourselves with our minds to a certain yes. extent for certain things, you know.
Yes.
But it does mean that every, like, clinical trial worth its weight in anything mm-hmm. has to have a placebo arm.
Yep.
Because if you tell someone, like, hey, I got a great new drug for you, you want to try it, and, like, all of a sudden they feel better, it's like, who knows if it was the placebo effect
yes.
or ketamine.
Yes.
So science is the way that we can do that we can find that out. And then through other kinds of studies that we can actually test the mechanism of how the hell mm-hmm. like ketamine might be having these effects.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, you can't trust a single study. And that's what we've learned. And that's, I think, what we keep getting caught up with. Like the, I don't like saying like the media, because I am the media, mm-hmm. but the media
yeah.
will often present a single study
mm-hmm.
and be, you know, sticking with the ketamine example and mm-hmm. be like, ketamine now cures depression or whatever. Because yeah. there was one study that maybe gave people, you know, ketamine and then checked them the next day
yep.
and was like, oh my God, their depression scores, which has happened. There have been studies like this where they get people yep. with serious, nasty depression,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe having suicidal thoughts, really mm-hmm. bad place, give them ketamine.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of them the next day, they're like, they don't even have depression. And there have been studies like that. And then, if you report that, you're like, oh my gosh.
Well, this is the cure.
This is the cure.
Right.
But you have to, and I understand the new cycle, yada, yada. But just so people understand sort of how science works, then you just got to wait and see what's going to happen with the other studies.
Right.
You want to test it in more people with different kinds of depression. And ketamine is a perfect example. So now we have more data mm-hmm. and we can see that it probably helps about 50% of the people who take it.
Mm.
And it probably affects on average last a couple of weeks.
Mm.
And then many people will go back to normal.
Mm.
So you see what I mean? Mm. How if you so that's where I think people start to think, like, can you trust science? Because you're like, wait, you just told me ketamine was the cure. Now it's not the cure.
Right.
When really it's just like the progression of knowledge.
Yep.
And so on Science Versus, and I would just like encourage people as you're looking on the internet at studies, you're like, is this just one study? Is mm-hmm. this a body of research? Mm-hmm. Like, how sure can we be that this is going to hold up?
Yep.
And it doesn't mean that first study was crap. It
yep.
just means, like, that's what they found once. Are they going to find it again?
Yes, yes. See, I think it's so important for people to remember we have to trust while also understanding that the research never ends.
It never ends. That's right.
Like, we will never have this perfect book filled with all the answers. Like, I mean, maybe in like, what, 5,000 years, if like whatever, if everything lasts that long, like, I don't know. It's like, I mean, maybe then.
That's exactly, yeah, that's right. And I think it
yeah.
sort of goes back to what you were saying about how we want a quick solution, and science yeah. is a process.
Yeah.
It's a frustrating long process.
Yeah.
But it's still the best we got. And it's still way better than someone saying.
Good,
and it's
too.
Pretty amazing.
It is actually amazing. Yeah. Like, I feel like a lot of us sort of, we're not grateful enough for the time that we live in. This is actually a phenomenal time to be alive, where, like, medicine is so advanced.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Like, we're curing shit. Like, you know, it's like crazy hearing stories about different diseases that were just wiping everyone out.
Yeah.
Like 100 years ago. And now it's no big deal.
Yeah.
It's no big deal.
It's crazy.
Or there's a vaccine, no one even gets it anymore. And we take it for granted, but also, you know, when there are things that go wrong and there are things that, like, we think we understand and then we don't, and then maybe some people, I don't know, we're all human and we're doing the best that we can. And yeah. I think at the end of the day, you know, yeah, there's the man who wants money, and then there's, you know, even the individuals who want money. But I think ultimately we all want to be happy and healthy. We do.
Yes.
Like, I think that is most of our goals.
Yes, yes. And I don't want to be, like, out here being like, you know, science is like, you know, like, come down from heaven. Yes. And, you know, right. God was like, right. Oh, yeah. There are problems with science. And, yep. And science does have biases. I mean, I was listening back to our episode on the G-spot that mm-hmm. we did, which has like a very funny history. It feels kind of dated now. Is anyone talking about the female G-spot?
I mean, I think people need to be talking about it.
Like, let's talk about it.
I actually don't know anything about the G-spot, which is crazy because like I'm the type of person to be like, okay, find it to like a guy. But then I'm like, I actually don't know what it is or where it is. I also don't know if anyone would feel good if you found it. Like, I actually don't know. But
the story of how the G-spot was born is wild.
Wait, can you give, let's do a brief detour and tell us about the G-spot.
Yeah, and then I'll come right back to how it fits into like science can be fucked sometimes.
Yes.
There was this nurse, Beverly Whipple, who I interviewed, still alive today. And, she, oh gosh, what was this? Let's put it in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Was doing this study in women who, when they orgasmed, they peed a little. And in some cases peed a lot and like needed like towels, and this was very upsetting for them. And so she and so she's studying these women who at the time, you know, very taboo, very embarrassed about this. Mm-hmm. And so she started examining them, which meant this is the time when video is going to be helpful. Yeah. I guess this is
yes,
my video.
Yes, there you go, hit it. Yes.
So she would take their vaginas and like just kind of like insert her finger and then kind of go around like in a clockwise direction and mm-hmm. be like, how does this feel? How does this feel? How does this feel? Mm-hmm. And she kept finding that around the if you imagine like your vagina's like a clock.
Yes, yes.
Like the 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.
Okay,
slot.
Okay, yeah.
Was like women would start smiling and get excited.
And, like, I love it.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then she ends up writing a book about it. She goes on the Phil Donahue show mm-hmm. and like we found archive from the Phil, and it's so funny because it's like so like, you know, but she's out there talking about like, you know, the best way to do it is with the woman on top and like missionary. She does something like missionary style just doesn't cut it. And
interesting.
I'm like in the 80s.
That's,
you know,
fucking amazing.
And you hear Phil Donahue go like, oh,
you know what? They can't handle it. They're like, we've never talked like this before. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, so she starts... So, and I think she did this talk. Once it starts blowing up, maybe before she wrote the book, she did this talk. Mm-hmm. And people were like, you have to name this thing. Mm-hmm. And at one point it was going to be called the Whipple Tickle because mm-hmm. her name is Beverly Whipple. Mm-hmm. But then they went for the G-spot because G-spot is like Dr. Graffenberg was like another doctor who maybe found this spot. Anyway, so it goes on Phil Donahue. It blows up. There's all these articles, you know, G-spot. Oh, my God. Can you find it? Let's find it. But in the meantime, like... No one knew, like, what was it? Like, is it nerves? Is it a gland?
Right,
like, is it, what's going on there? Yeah. And it took until the 90s, like 1998, I think it was, when an Australian urologist, Helen O'Connell, was on a totally different track. She was reading, this is where we get back to science can be fucked sometimes. Uh-huh. She wasn't really aware of all this G-spot talk at all.
Yeah.
She was like studying anatomy. She's like a uni student. And her anatomy textbook basically didn't have the clitoris in it.
No,
like
what?
I asked her like it was a blank spot there. And she said basically a blank spot.
What?
So she's like using this anatomy textbook for 4 years. You know, it's got a perfectly formed penis in there.
Oh, yeah.
Without it, of course. There's no doubt.
There's like too much information about the penis in it.
Yeah, there's like, but nothing on the clitoris, nothing.
What?
And she's getting madder and madder and madder about this. And then one day she gets given this book by a group of feminists in America. It was mm-hmm. like a friend of hers was like, you want to see this book? And she was like, yeah, I want to see this book. And it had these beautiful diagrams of like the vulva and the vagina. And these women had like tried to look at at their vagina, but they had this line in it that was like, we unfortunately didn't have cadavers. So we mm-hmm. couldn't like dissect to see like what's going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
And Helen O'Connell's like, I have access to cadavers. Yes. Like, I'm at a medical school. We got, like, cadavers coming out of our ass.
Everywhere.
Like, yeah. So she starts a study in, like, the 90s.
Whoa.
One of the first scientific studies actually dissecting, like, where is the clitoris? What's going on? What's going on in there?
Yeah.
Because now I think it's fairly well known that, like, the tip that you see is, like, the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. You know, it's this very large, you know, this is, like, something that's really good about this. Like, you guys know. We know this, right?
Yes.
I feel like even, you know, 6 years ago when we were looking at the episode, people were like, whoa, the clitoris is so big. But now we know.
Yeah.
It's, like, big. It's got, like, a Burt Reynolds mustache kind of vibe coming down. It's big. But she worked that out in 1998, that paper was published.
Wow.
And it was only then where we could start being like, wait, so what's the G-spot?
Yeah.
To take it all back around.
Yeah.
And she was like, I can't see anything where in this, like, 11 to 1 position, but what I can see is this huge clitoris.
Yeah. Wow, this thing is big. Oh, my God. No one's talking about it. So wait, is that actually what it is? Is that the clitoris just extends inside? So
yeah,
then it's
for
like,
some women.
So it's a piece of your... Right, because I feel like some people can't orgasm vaginally.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So it's probably... Yeah. So now our understanding of the vagina and that whole region and the clitoris is like that the clitoris, the vaginal wall, even the urethra, which is like where we pee out of,
mm-hmm.
they all sort of interact in this very interesting way that I don't know, we use this terrible analogy in the podcast where we were like puppies dancing.
Yeah, how cute.
Like all coming around.
I love that. That's sweet.
And that is now like the vaginal urethral complex.
Yeah.
Which is probably what the G-spot was in some of these women. And so there is no spot, is bottom line. But, like, why I think it reflects, like, that science can suck sometimes is, like, why wasn't the clitoris in that anatomy?
Yeah, like, how did that get missed?
How did that? And the thing is that in the 1900s, like, you know, Grey's Anatomy.
Of course.
Yes, yes. So Grey's Anatomy is a textbook. It's an anatomy textbook before it was a TV show.
Yep.
In the 1900s, they had the clitoris.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Late 1940s, clitoris gone.
Why?
I don't know.
Weird.
We just have fucked. We just, our, like, entire understanding.
Are women's,
of, like,
orgasms bigger? Is that true? Have you read into that?
We did. Like, we did a whole episode on the orgasm gap.
Yeah.
You know, this idea, like, so men, if you ask, like, cis men, like, how often do you orgasm when you have sex? Uh-huh. 95% will say yes.
Uh-huh.
You ask, like, women, do you want to have a guess? How many?
Well, let's use my own life. No, it's so mean. Oh, I'm so sorry to everyone. No. Oh, God.
You're
I don't want to go
40.
Too low. I was going to say 40.
Yeah,
I was going to say 40%.
65%.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, you want to guess. That's straight women.
Mm.
Do you want to guess gay women?
Oh, it must be way higher. I mean, I feel like that would be like 95.
Yeah, it's 89%.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that tells us that, like, this is largely not a biological thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it's that much harder to, you know, get us off.
No.
This is a cultural thing mostly.
Do you think it is harder for women to orgasm? Like, actually?
Yeah, so we looked into the science of this. Like, why?
Get into it.
Yeah, what is this orgasm? What's causing it? Mm-hmm. Is the female orgasm, like, such a big mystery? Exactly. That was our exact question. And there's been these phenomenal studies. Like, I love our sex episodes. They're so much fun.
So fun.
Right? Because you can really dive deep.
Yes.
Because we're just talking science, man.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
But it's like also no one's talking about it in a day-to-day as much because it is sort of even still sometimes a taboo.
A little taboo. Yeah,
it's
yeah,
so
yeah.
fun. I
yeah.
love it.
Yeah. So they, for example, they've gotten people to go into MRIs
mm-hmm.
and orgasm and
mm-hmm.
like either masturbating or getting their partners.
Mm-hmm.
But MRIs just as like fun details. Have you ever had one?
An MRI, yes.
Yeah, so it's loud. It's
yes.
loud.
Yes. It's a very weird experience.
It's a weird experience. It'd be really hard to orgasm in there.
So hard?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Not too
hard. Like, and also, like, it's like, do you get any like stimulation? Like, you have not, you're in there alone with a loud sound. Good luck using your imagination. I like, you know what I mean? And I know they're not like playing a video for you. Like, it's like, you're really like on your own. That's so sad.
Yeah.
That is so hard.
It's so hard. And not only that, if on an MRI, you know how you have to be really still?
Yeah.
Because movement is the killer of an MRI. You need the image to be
That's
crystal
true.
Clear. And so researchers had to design a helmet which she called the researcher, Dr. Nan Wise, she called it the like Hannibal Lecter happy helmet.
Ew.
Because I think it like it ended up like covering the face just so they like wouldn't move. So they had to wear this helmet. Then they had to like, you know, sort themselves out, or they had a partner do it. But because it was so loud, the scientists had to be like relaying information. Like she described it as like a deranged like a flight host.
Where
she was like your partner has started orgasming now. And then, like, your partner has stopped orgasming now. Through studies like researchers have discovered that the orgasm is a big brain event. There's a lot going on in your brain, which is how it feels, right? So it's not that surprising. And there's from what we can tell, the differences between like the male and female brain under orgasm, very similar. Very similar. There's other similarities going on, like when you look at the like nerves around the like vagina versus the penis. So the biology doesn't seem to be able to explain the huge differences. One researcher did suggest that because the penis is external, there's like more to play with, I guess. Like, so you could like see, is this a sensitive area? Is this a sensitive area? And you can do that with the vagina, obviously. It's just a little more difficult.
It is.
And, you know, and she was saying she studies people in the lab, and she's like, you know, sometimes we are like poking around the vagina and, you know, we'll be like, is this nice? Is this nice?
Yeah.
And they just like can't find it on some women.
It's kind of like a mess sometimes in there. Like,
it's
even
harder.
For me, like even with my own vagina, I'm like, it's a mess. Cause I'm like, it's not
a beautiful mess.
A beautiful mess. Yes. Obsessed with it, but happy to have it. But like, literally she's awesome. I love her, but she's just, but like even sometimes with me, like I had to learn, even when it's your own vagina, it's not like you know where your clit is.
Yeah.
Immediately.
All the time.
Like you learn that later in life. Whereas like if you have a penis, you can see the penis.
100, yes.
It's right there. There's no like, oh, wait, where is it?
There's no discovery. Right.
You know, some women I know have like maybe a smaller clitoris. So like you have to like, and it might be like under fold. So you have to like actually move things around to then see it. Like it's very interesting. But I mean,
yeah. So that tells us that like, so maybe there's a little bit of biology there.
Yeah.
But the fact that gay women can orgasm almost 90% of the time tells us that a huge chunk of this orgasm gap is social. It's social. And like actually surveys have been done of like college like men, and they know where the clitoris is. They're clearly just not finding it. They don't care. You know, like, or some men, like,
oh,
this
no,
is social.
Definitely. Yeah.
And there's surveys that have been done of women that, like, we prioritize male orgasm. That's when sex ends. And it's really sad that, like, that hasn't changed, right? That hasn't changed.
No, it has not.
Yeah, and that sucks. Yeah. Like, I remember when I was in high school, I was, like, the gender gap on many things. I was like, we're so close to getting that, right? You know, like once we get the wages sorted, equality's like in you know, we got it. We got this.
Then we're both gonna come every time.
Exactly.
And it's gonna be fucking awesome.
And now I'm like, no. Like, no. Like, it's still the primacy of the penis.
Yep.
It's still sex is done when they come.
Yep.
It's like, it's all, and you can see it in the data that like women will say, like, I prioritize them coming.
I know.
Yeah.
Like, I've done that.
Because they should be like, you know, okay, I now it's your turn.
Yeah.
That's how it should work.
But it's also like, I think a lot of guys too are like scared to ask. Like, they're scared. Well, that's just thing anyway. But like, people are, it's a very hard conversation to have to be like, you're not doing it.
Yeah.
Like, it's not working.
Yeah.
Like, it ruins the, like...
It doesn't need to ruin it.
That way.
It could just be like, let's try it this way. Let's, like, it could be a fun thing.
Totally.
It doesn't need to be, like, you're ragging on them or anything.
No.
It could just be like, hey, let's try this. Let's try that.
Exactly.
Do you mind if I touch myself while we're doing this?
Yes.
Like, this could be... Yeah, it doesn't need to be negative.
I think one day, I think we'll be alive when the stats go up and the girlies are having their orgasms just as much, and it's all, maybe we'll be alive for that. That'd be such a treat.
That would be great. That'd be great. I really thought, you know how like there was like big dick energy a couple of summers ago? I was like, what about like generous lover energy?
What about excited clit energy?
Yes,
you know what I mean? Like, what about well-attended to clitoris energy. Why not? Or why are we not doing that?
Yes.
You're like, that's what we
need. We could go through the celebrities in our lives and be like, you know, Cardi B, well-attended clitoris
you
energy.
You can tell.
Yes.
I like, you can tell. No, there's been phases of my life. If you scroll through my Instagram, you can tell when my clitoris was not well-attended to. You can see that shit in my eyes. Okay? And then all of a sudden, it's like one day, there's a little glisten back. What happened?
Well-attended,
you know what I mean? It's like
energy.
You can see it in the eyes. Okay, so we're starting that as a hashtag. You guys all take that and run with it. Oh, that's so good. We just unintentionally answered one of my first questions, which was, let's talk about the orgasm, because that's one of the things that you've dug into. You dug into so many things. We need to dig into, like, there's a few things we need to dig
into.
Great. That I know that you're like, you've done the dirty work. You've done the research. You've whatever.
Yes.
And one of them is very relevant to me because I was addicted for many years vaping. Let's have the vaping conversation.
Yes.
Because
how is your journey going?
Great.
By the way,
what happened to me was I like made an episode, a podcast episode, being like, I'm quitting.
Yes.
Because I woke up one day and I was like, I'm quitting.
Yeah.
I quit. Then I went through a rough patch and I was like, there's no fucking way. Like, because nicotine withdrawals are tough.
Yeah.
And it was like, I just can't. I need this. Like, this is my pacifier. I need this back. So I started again. Then a month ago, I quit again. And I've gone a month.
Yeah.
You know, my goal was, okay, I'm going to quit by the time I'm like 25. Because you ultimately have to quit when you get pregnant, right?
Right.
So it's like, I don't want to deal with pregnancy and having to quit nicotine, which is so
emotional. Because
already
when you got to like cut down on your caffeine. There's already a bunch of shit to do, right?
Too many stimulants that I love will have to exit my life.
Yeah.
Alcohol as well. Like, I really can't handle all of this quitting at once. So to not have a glass of wine on a Friday, wow, that's rough. So anywho, tell me everything about vaping, because I'll tell you what I always had excuses. Because when you're addicted to something, you always have excuses. You're like, no, like, you know, it's not even like, there's no tar, like with the vape. There's no tar.
Yes.
There's nothing
combustible.
There's nothing burning. You know, I remember somebody told me once, actually, I think it was like a guy I dated for like a month. He was telling me, because he was super addicted to the vape too.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, it's totally fine. It's like the vegetable glycerin, the base of it is... He said something about it being like water soluble, so it like it won't stick.
Like it's vegan. It's
like
okay.
He's like, it's actually really organic, so it's like chia seed vibes. So it's totally fine. It's like, it's super kale energy. It's super Erewhon coated. They'll start selling it at Erewhon soon.
It's organic, babe.
Yeah,
but also,
oh my god, wait, this is. Yeah. I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'm so excited because he was like basically saying like, oh, so it's safe. Like it won't stick to anything. You just exhale it. It's fine.
Yeah,
and then also. Something that a conclusion I came to was, hold on a minute. There are all these vapes that are supposed to help you quit nicotine and they're supposed to be completely safe, but they're quite literally the exact same ingredients. The only difference is there's no nicotine. And it's like, I get that then helps you sort of like, if your oral fixation is what you're the most sort of drawn to more than even the nicotine itself. See, for me, it was always nicotine as a stimulant. Like, I think it helps me.
Yeah.
But they're marketing these alternative vapes with no nicotine as being a healthy alternative. And it's like, this is still you inhaling something.
Yes.
So what's the difference there? And there's flavors involved here. And I actually tried one of those once, and I will not say the name. It made my lungs feel very weird.
Oh, interesting.
And I did not, like, it made me feel like, heavy. And I was like, this I don't like. And I immediately stopped because I was like, I do not like this. But I was like, anyway, so all of this rambling to say.
What's going on?
What's going on with the vape?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, because honestly, if somebody were to tell me, it's actually totally fine, I'd be like, amazing. I'm gonna fucking vape then. Like, I would literally, if someone told me right now, okay, it's totally safe, I'd be like, peace out. I would I would literally wait. I would have my babies so that, you know, because I was whatever. And then I would then vape for the remainder of my life. So please tell me everything.
Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, I'm not going to tell you that they're totally safe.
But
I think a lot of the like confusion out there is because the vast majority of data out there shows that vaping is safer than smoking.
Mm.
But that is because like smoking cigarettes is so bad. Like, I feel like we sort of missed out on how bad it was because already by the time we were sort of coming into our own, like, a lot, there'd been all these like ad campaigns of like how bad it is. And, you know, it, we've just sort of forgotten. But one academic told me that like cigarette smoking, it's kind of like, you know, it's a bit of a cartoon example, but it's kind of the equivalent of like putting your mouth over like a car, like exhaust fumes and just being like,
yeah,
you know, like the amount of cancers that it caused. I think it's like 1 in 3 deaths from cancer in the US can be directly caused by smoking, like directly contributed to smoking. It's crazy how bad, like it's crazy that it's legal, but it's so bad for you.
Yep.
And so to say that something is safer than smoking, it's like saying like, you know, like being, you know, smoking is being like hit by a truck and then like dragged for 10 miles.
Yes.
You
yes.
know, vaping is like being hit by a Jeep, you know, and you're not dragged, but like, so that's one thing. So I think like in the UK, for example, there's this big push to like use e-cigarettes to quit smoking because that is still considered safer.
Yep.
The vast majority of studies, although I will say like there was a study that came out recently that kind of suggests otherwise, but I think going back to our point of like, you look at the data, that's what it suggests. Okay. So given that, so if you're currently smoking cigarettes and want a way to quit and think vaping might help you, I think the data suggests that's a good idea.
Yeah.
But vaping compared to nothing, compared to air, beautiful, beautiful air.
Yes.
This is where we're getting, this is where the friendship is going to get into trouble.
Yes. So, I need this. I need to hear this. Continue.
Yeah. So for a long time, and I almost feel like it was probably like, you know, really in the last like 10 years or whatever. So first there was just like all this talk. It's safe. It's safe. It's safe. And I feel like that's when a bunch of people started taking it.
Yep.
And then the data starts coming out. Even though there were always academics that were like, look, it's probably not great. Like you are still breathing crap into your lungs.
There's nothing, anytime you're inhaling anything that's not clean air, it's probably bad.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so we now, so for example, we talked to this researcher who had like interviewed something like 3,000 kids who were like, I don't know, kids, late teens, early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And found that if you vaped, you were way more likely to have symptoms like coughing and wheezing.
Mm-hmm.
2/3 of the people in their sample had symptoms like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the researcher was like, this is not normal. Like a 19-year-old wheezing, you know, that's not good. Like
that's a bad vibe.
That's a bad vibe. Like that's not doing good things to your lungs.
Yes.
And like, and it's sort of, you know, you can deal with coughing. It's not great.
Yeah.
Wheezing, you know, but it's sort of thought that these problems that it's causing to your lungs are like the canary in the coal mine. Like if you keep vaping, it suggests that something's going on and your lungs are having trouble.
Yep.
And it kind of, if you keep vaping, keep bringing that stuff in, it doesn't get better.
Yep.
And then we have data like on the flavors, for example. So the weird thing with the flavors is that like a lot of them have been approved for safety for eating. Like that's...
Oh.
So like that's what's wild is that that's where most of the flavors come from. It's like the like cinnamaldehyde is like the chemical they use for cinnamon vapes, which I don't think is a very popular flavor.
By the way, horrible flavor. Ew. Who's smoking that? Y'all are weird for that. Okay, ew.
Exactly.
This just so like... I'll tell you, I haven't smoked that one, so we're good. Continue.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why I feel so bad for scientists. They're like, we finally worked out cinnamaldehyde, and then everyone's like, fuck that.
You're like, we don't even like that flavor. It's like, I like the melon one or the lychee
out
one.
The ice stuff.
So
that's how they started getting the flavors. They were like, oh, we already know, like it gives whatever this chemical gives like a cherry, like to your cherry ripes or whatever. Like what if you just inhaled it? And no one had really done the studies for inhalation. They were just like, it's safe to eat.
Yeah.
But we know that like our stomach has acids. Like our stomach evolved to eat weird, potentially dangerous shit. Like
1,000%.
Yeah, right. You're eating berries and you're like, this wasn't great, but just like get it out. You'll be fine.
Yep.
But your lungs, like, weren't designed to, like, shove, you know, you weren't, like, haven't evolved for that sort of industrial style clean.
Totally.
And we already have examples where stuff that has been safe to eat, we know is not good for your lungs. And so the example scientists like to use is diacetyl, which is, like, a buttery flavor that it shouldn't be put in vapes because we know it's really harmful. But it's put on popcorn. It gives like the buttery taste of popcorn.
And yeah.
As far as we know, really safe, like very yummy.
Yeah.
But then in a popcorn factory a couple of decades ago,
Oh.
This is how scientists were like desperate to like, do we know anything about its inhalation? So popcorn factory where they're making the diacetyls going into the popcorn, but there was an accident and a bunch of people inhaled a ton of it. And a lot of them, their lungs just like fucked up. A couple needed like lung transplants as a result. And that's like and it's called popcorn lung, which maybe you've heard of. And which sort of sounds like, oh, your lungs turning into popcorns, but it's actually from this popcorn factory.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was like the first example where you know, we know that diacetyl is bad for your lungs. And there have been examples of people who have inhaled it in a diacetyl in vapes. And then it hasn't been good for their lungs. So, just generally, and then the propylene glycol, which is the stuff that makes it like fog, that makes it like, it's like a little fog machine. It is actually the same chemical that's in theater smoke machines.
Oh, God. the amount of years that I inhaled that is so bad. Okay, continue. Tell me the truth.
Right? I mean, it's like fascinating from like a chemical perspective that you're like, oh, that stage like fog machine.
It's like, oh, my God, I'm in like a fucking Halloween haunted house in my lungs. My lungs literally for years look like a Halloween haunted house.
That is exactly.
For better or for worse. Let me tell you, I was having fun blowing my O's, but I was really like, but it can't be good.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, or like you're at a club or whatever.
It's like a rave in my lungs.
Yes. It was,
okay, yeah. Okay,
yeah, that's right. And there's evidence that's also not great for your lungs. You know, and they even have like studies from theater workers who have had to like smoke, like inhale a ton of this stuff and
interesting.
And things like that. So we know all these they're not good. They're not good. And then there's also some upcoming research into nicotine itself, whether that, because there's been a debate for a long time about whether nicotine is even that bad for you. Because like it's addicting, and it's the reason, as you well know, like that you want to keep coming back.
Yep.
So in that way, it's bad because it's like bringing along the
being
flavors.
Addicted to anything's not good, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it's a philosophical debate.
That is because see, it's funny you say that because that was something that I like did research on. I always would do research and like cherry pick the studies or things that I would look at, like to. Like, allow me to continue vaping.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like,
I
would literally cherry pick
the
article. It was, I fully know what I was doing, but I would be like, I read one article once that nicotine as a chemical, it's the same as caffeine. It might be a little bit more addicting, but when it comes to like its risks, I guess, equal.
That was kind of how I had understood it as well. And then when we did this episode, and dove in. That was like kind of for a long time. And because it's so hard to study, because most of our nicotine research comes from smokers. And so you're like, how are you supposed to know what caused the damage? Like the nicotine in the tobacco or everything else that you're smoking?
Exactly.
Like when you burn the tobacco. And so now they're doing research and it's really at its early stages. Mm. So what we've known for a while is that smokers have a high risk of getting depression.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, there was this question of like, correlation causation, like which is basically this question of like what did the
chicken or the egg
did the smoking cause the depression? Were these people already likely to like
become depressed? People less likely to care about their well-being, therefore smoke
or smoke to already help with the symptoms of depression? Like it just like wasn't clear whether nicotine was. Then they started to see the same pattern with vapors. So vapors were more likely to get depression. Again, you have the same, like, what was going on. So now, to answer that question, science often uses, like, rodent studies, basically, to try and find, like, a mechanism, like, how on earth could nicotine, like, what do we know about nicotine in the brain?
Mm-hmm.
Or in the rat brain? How could it cause depression? Does that even make sense? You know, this early research, and the problem is it's in rats, it's not in humans. But what they're finding is that, like, there are some areas in the brain, like the reward center, that, like, makes things feel good. You know, when you smell a flower and you're like, that was nice.
Yeah.
Like, nicotine does seem to be affecting the reward center in these rats.
Yep. That makes sense.
It makes sense. And so there is this question that maybe for some people, it's sort of like, dampening your enjoyment is sort of the theory, which we know is a symptom of depression, is that like things that used to give you joy or that perhaps give other people joy don't, you're like, whatever. And so that, you know, so that's kind of where the research is at, which is like, we're seeing this trend, we see it in the rats, and we'll have to wait and see. But I don't want to oversell it that nicotine's going to cause everyone's depression, because that's clearly not the case. But we're just seeing that pattern. And so it's just another reason, I think, if people want to reduce consumption.
The few times I've quit, insane depression.
Right.
I'm a very anxious person anyway. So I think anytime anything changes,
yeah,
my anxiety is just the first thing to react, right? But horrible anxiety, like the worst, that was really bad.
Oh, yeah.
It was really bad. And like mood swings and like all these issues. And then, you know, now my nicotine consumption, if you were to like look at how much I'm consuming now versus when I was using the vape, it's much less. And I do feel much more emotionally stable.
Great.
Which is interesting.
Great.
Like, and my parents noticed that too. Like, they're like, oh my God, when you're not, like, I always get so mad at my mom because she'd be like, I swear to God, the vape makes you like a wreck. Like, it makes you a wreck. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I've been vaping since I was like 16, bitch. Me like being so mean to my mom. And it's like, because I'm vaping. Because I'm vaping. It's like, I'm being rude to her because I'm like so like strung on this shit.
What are you saying? What are you saying? I'm like, shut up, emotionally stable right now.
I think it definitely made me, or I noticed that sort of, I don't know. I think there is an emotional impact.
Yeah.
Overall, the consensus is we don't actually know that much about vaping, but we know that we shouldn't be doing it.
All the signs are pointing to if you cannot do it, that's great.
Yeah.
And the less that you do it, the better.
Right. Have you done anything about alcohol?
Yeah.
Is there any way...
Talk to me.
Is there any way, like, to drink alcohol? Because I've seen so many contradicting things. Like,
yeah,
there's been the study, a glass of red wine every night, it doesn't hurt.
Yes,
I've seen that, okay? But then I've also seen, like, tequila with lemon, totally healthy. That's actually totally fine. And my mom was my mom texted me that once and was like, oh my God, see, this is what you order. So it's totally fine. Tequila soda with lime or lemon, it's totally fine. And I was like, yay! Or like, you know, only on the weekends. It's like if you only have it a few times a week, right? Like if you save it for special occasions, it's totally fine. What are your thoughts on drinking?
Yeah, so the alcohol episode was one that like actually made me change my habits and
really
made me change the way I drink. It's actually kind of like a really interesting science story of why we thought alcohol was good for your heart. So basically researchers like did these studies where they got, you know, it's like what if someone were like, how would you run a study to find out whether alcohol was good for your heart? You're like, we get 10,000 people, whatever. We ask like, how much alcohol do you drink? And then you follow them for a bit of time and you see whose heart like gets
looks
fucked.
The best.
All looks the best.
Yep.
And what they kept finding is that like the people who drank alcohol seemed to have better hearts than people who drank no alcohol whatsoever.
Interesting.
Okay. And so they were like, this is amazing. Like, you know, I think maybe the first studies were to do with wine, but then later studies came out about like all the alcohols and they were like, oh my gosh. Like, and then they start telling the story, antioxidants must be good for your heart. Now we have a mechanism, we're in. And then some researchers were like, wait a second. Like, who are these people who aren't drinking any alcohol at all? And this was like pre the non-alc era. You know, and you might think it would be, and I would have still thought like, no, like maybe it's like my body is a temple, super healthy.
Yep.
But it turned out that the group of people who weren't drinking any alcohol at all were actually people who were sick. And their doctors had said, you need to stop drinking alcohol.
Right.
And so then there was this big like battle in science, like maybe it's a little bit good for you, even if you blah, blah, blah. But now I think that the thinking is it's not really that good for your heart. And it was just this like... this like, you know, science progresses. And then, but what we do know is that it is a carcinogen and it does increase your risk of cancer.
I didn't know it was a carcinogen.
Yeah. And
which is crazy.
Yeah.
I should have known that.
The breakdown products of alcohol can like muck up your DNA and like, and it causes, and that is what, because like when you get older, people you love start getting cancer.
Yep.
And that's what made me really cut down my drinking. I was like, because we do so much to prevent cancer, like, you know, you're like, I'll go do exercise, I'll do this, I'll do that. And then I was like, but I was still drinking a ton.
Totally.
And I'm
totally.
Like, oh, what am I doing? Like, I don't need to be drinking a ton.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd also like, I mean, at least for me, it makes me anxious and depressed. Like, it fucks with my brain.
Yeah.
Like, when I'm, you know.
You want to create, like, crazy.
Yes.
We did an episode on hangovers. Mm-hmm. So what
that was on my list.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
This get
was,
into it.
I think the most surprising like episode we've done.
Yep.
Like, what do you think is the cause of hangovers?
My guess would be that your liver is processing. I have no idea, by the way. So this is so random. So like, this is my guess.
You asked, like, we did like Voxies on the street.
Yes.
Like Vox Pops. And like, yes, everyone had the same answer.
Really?
It did not involve the liver. Dehydration.
Oh.
But that's,
you're kidding.
No. But that's what, like, I think a lot of listeners, that's what I thought it was, dehydration. Oh, that's the thinking.
That's what everyone thinks, is that it's being dehydrated.
You're being dehydrated. Yeah, because alcohol, you know, there's this story that alcohol is a diuretic and makes you pee.
Yep.
And then you lose a lot of water and you become dehydrated.
Yep.
But actually, anyone who has had a hangover known about or thought they knew about this dehydration thing. Mm-hmm. Like, if you ever, I definitely have had like a terrible hangover, and I'm like, before we did the study, and I'm like, yeah, I gotta drink water. And like, I am peeing like water. Like,
yeah,
it is,
yeah,
like
peeing clear. You're like, yeah, I'm fucking fine.
It's clear. Yeah. Like, clearly my body is rehydrated, whatever. Yeah. And I'm still have a terrible hangover. So the current thinking is that it's actually caused when your body breaks down alcohol, it produces like like the breakdown products are kind of like little toxics, like just a little bit toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates this inflammatory response because your body like has this immune system where it's like, what's all these toxins doing in my body?
Yep.
And the immune system comes like, and it starts to be like, get rid of all these toxins, creates inflammation. And that's what's thought to cause like the terrible like headaches, these sorts of like, the real like hangover effects where you're just like, oh, like brain fog, stuff like that. It's inflammation.
That makes complete sense. Okay, wait. This is completely, this last topic that I need, because this is so me. We cannot skip this one. Gossiping. I need the science on gossip. I'm such a gossiper. I am. But I believe,
yes,
that it's healthy. Like, that's my belief.
Yeah.
Because, to an extent, I think that it's healthy when it's done responsibly.
Like, when it's not just like,
when it's not harmful.
Did you see his hat the other day? Or like, it's, yes, not just mean and bitchy.
It's when it's like, for the sake of analysis. Well, let's discuss gossip. Like, I think a lot of people will say gossip is all bad. You know, it's like, right, that's a negative thing. There's nothing redeeming there. And then some people will be like, no, this is how we connect as human beings. We should gossip all the time. But I don't think that that's probably where the science lands. Like, what's the ruling on gossip?
Oh, that's, I mean, that kind of is where the science lands. So we know.
Interesting. Okay.
We know that gossip can be harmful, you know, particularly in like high school, middle school, we've all been there. It's it can be really nasty. It can ostracize. It can, you know, if you're the target of gossip, it can increase
your
risk
bad.
Of mental health issues. There's also like a lot of studies done in the workplace, which I hadn't thought of as like a gossip mongery place, but of course it is.
It totally is, yeah.
And,
I
you know,
can see that.
Studies that show that like gossipy workplaces, people tend to be less creative, less happy, you know, and we've all been there as
totally.
Well.
Totally.
And it's like stifling to be in a gossipy workplace. But then the positives. So interestingly, like there was this really fun study that got people, the Spanish study that got people to, they were scanning their brains, I think it was an EEG, and gave them either statements that were gossip or statements that were just like trivia.
Right.
I think they started a sentence that was like, the highest mountain in Germany is blah. And then they said, how interested are you in this answer?
Yep.
And people, you know, would answer whatever, very interested, not interested at all. And then for the gossip ones, I think there was one that was like, who did Barack Obama have an affair with?
Yes, totally.
And people were like, you know, not interested. Like, that's not me.
Yes.
I'm not interested in
that. Yes.
Then he went back to them like a week later and was like, so do you remember what the highest mountain in Germany is? People tended to be like, no. And they're like, do you remember the answer to the Obama question? Which was Beyonce.
Yes.
Such a stupid.
Yes.
Which
yes.
was this huge like rumor in Europe. Like,
totally.
And so we know that like we remember this content. Mm-hmm. Also, when he looked back at the brain data, he could see that people's brains sort of lit up. They were, it's like the brains were giving them away.
Mm.
The brains were more excited about the gossip too.
Mm-hmm.
Even though people said like, I don't care about that. Like, I don't.
So they're morally like, I don't care about that. But deep down, they're like Googling it the second they're out of the MRI scan.
Exactly.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
is something about gossip that we love.
Yep.
And there is a bonding component to it, without a doubt. Like, you meet new friends, you know, who know your other, it's like a connector.
Yep.
You know, you can feel that love in the room when you got some great story about a friend.
Oh,
it may not be
good.
Bitchy. It may, yeah. So there is like a bonding component. And so I think like where our episode landed, and maybe it's where the science landed, is like, if you could gossip in a way that isn't going to hurt someone else.
Yes.
If you could be a little careful with how you tell a story.
Yes.
You know, then you could get the benefits of gossiping.
Yes.
Without the detriment.
Yes.
Yes. And also, there was this fun study that I think tracked middle schoolers and that said that if someone is saying really negative gossip, which really only happens in middle school, I feel like.
When you grow up, you
abandon those friends pretty quickly.
Yep.
But if the next person in line, like say someone was like, oh my gosh, like Jeremy's pants today look really stupid.
Yeah.
And then the next person said, oh, I actually think the pants are cool.
Mm.
That was like the fizzle. Like the gossip ended. You needed that second person to be like, oh yeah, him and his stupid pants. And then it was like wildfire.
Yes, yes.
So you can be like the savior of the gossip. If someone's just saying something mean, if you like punch it down, it's like, oh, not a good story. Like,
that's true.
So that's what the study found. So you could be the savior of the gossip.
Or you could not. Like, no, I do believe though that for somebody who is like me, for example, who loves gossip like I do, although I'm so, so protected about it. Like I have like four people in my life, maybe five that I gossip with.
I was just about to ask you, what's the best bit of gossip
you've heard recently? I'm so good about, I'll share some gossip with you after, I'll come up with something. But it's like, I never share it on the internet. A lot of people go on their podcast and are like, let's gossip. It's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
That's like the worst thing you could do for society. Okay. So, you know, it's like a handful of people only when I know that it will never get back to the person, like, and that's fine. And then also it's not all, but I have noticed that even though I'm somebody who's prone to gossip, enjoys gossip, loves gossip, believes in gossip, thinks it's crucial for society, I also know that you have to, it can be negative even for the person who loves it and who wants to discuss it if it's not done right. Like you
don't want to be like getting enjoyment off other people's pain as well. Like I don't think
it has to be fair.
Yeah, that's not a good side to the soul.
No.
I guess you're not really going to feel great after
It has to be in good faith. Like you have to like, if you're going to be shitting on someone, they have to have shit first. Like, so it's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, they need to have, like, done something genuinely bad.
Get me that on a t-shirt.
I know. That's so easy.
You're gonna be shitting on someone.
I'm gonna, now, if you guys make anybody out there merch companies, I'm gonna be making that.
They
so
have
it'll
to
be
shit first.
It'll be really expensive, but I'll make sure, just cause, yeah. Get ready.
But I just remembered another fun fact from that episode, which is that men gossip basically as much as women do.
Whoa.
Yeah. So they've done these studies where they like put microphones on people and then switch them like on and off.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we love science. We can objectively measure this stuff.
Yes.
At different times. Like they find that men do it too. Men do it too. And
yes,
the definition of gossip is, it's a very loose one. It's just talking about someone when they're not there.
Yep.
So it's not necessarily mean.
Yep.
But men, women, we all do it.
I refuse to date a guy who will not gossip with me. Like, I'm actually not kidding. That is a deal breaker. Like, if there's...
Because if they're going to be annoying about it, like...
No, I'm like, well. If I want to be like, oh, like this, you know, this girl was like so rude to me today and she did this and blah, 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 blah. I refuse to go on a second date with a man who, I don't really go on dates. It's not very Gen Z. But anyway, I refuse to entertain somebody who will not be like, wait, like, what was she wearing? Like, I need a guy who
they gotta have fun with it.
No, I need a guy who will meet me there. And it's true. There are, it's not as stereotypically, it's a woman thing. But if you allow everyone gossips.
It's everyone.
It's really everyone.
It's really not a girl thing.
No,
yeah.
It's not.
I think maybe some of the studies show that like sometimes women do mean a gossip on it, but everyone's talking about everyone else. Otherwise, what are you going to talk about?
No, like actually, what else is there to talk about? No, I'm not kidding. What else is there? I think about that sometimes. Like, yeah, you can talk about art. You can talk about yourself. You can talk about music. You can talk about, you can talk about philosophy, but when you, but, okay, but that's like, oh, okay, great. There, now you have an hour used up. What else is there? Now there's gossip.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's when the gossip comes in. Okay, so that's great. So now I know that.
You can feel good about it. Science approves of your gossip.
Okay, so I can't vape, but I can have a glass of wine every once in a while and I can fucking gossip.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Life is good. And you know what? And
you can orgasm.
I know. I was going to say, and I can orgasm.
Every fucking time.
Yes! You just need, oh my God.
There are other ways to enjoy sex and being with each other. You don't know, not so much pressure on the orgasm.
No, I'm sorry, but
if they're doing it, you can do it.
No, there's a phase, I think, in every young woman's life where it's like, damn, it's like not happening, huh? Like you're
Look, I will say like, it took mid-20s before I was even horny.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was, which I actually, it was coming on the show, I was like, oh, what is something that like I think is an important message that we don't talk about enough.
Yes.
Because there's so much pressure, particularly in high school, maybe in college too, about like, oh, she's frigid.
Oh, I was so frigid.
You know, but were you frigid or were you just not horny?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. And also, I wasn't, I don't think I was, it was not possible for me because you can't mentally get there unless you feel safe.
But I remember like sitting around when I lived in a share house in Sydney with an amazing three other women, and we were sitting around, and I guess I would have been in my mid-20s then, and they were all talking about the first time they masturbated, and one of them was like, I never remember a time I didn't masturbate.
Whoa!
They were like, I kind of remember rubbing up against stuff when I was 3 years old. Like, I didn't even think about it as masturbating. Another one said when I was 13, that's when I was going down in there. And they turned to me, and I was like, I haven't done it.
I so get it because I didn't until I came from like my first orgasm was from a guy.
Yeah.
Like doing it for me.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
my me, first
yeah,
boyfriend.
Yeah, me too.
I was like, what?
Yeah.
And I didn't even know. It was crazy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. No one's like talking to you about it. No one's like giving you advice. And unlike with guys, it's not like right out there. So
you
have to have like an urge from within. And I just like didn't have
that.
You
don't know what you're missing.
Yeah, until my mid-20s. And so like I really wish the conversation, instead of it being like frigid or whatever fucking words they're using to like judge women and girls who don't want to have sex, it's just like, do you want sex right now? You don't have to want sex right now.
Yes.
You know, like you're 13, you're 16, you're 19. Maybe you're just not horny. And like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And so like, whatever, when I was 25, I was like, fucking awesome.
I love that. I'm so of that. Like, it's because it's not even good when you're younger anyway. Like, it's not that, it's not, okay, so like, for example, it's always like, oh, like have sex. Like, you know, you want to like have sex as soon as you can. This was like the belief when you're, you know, in high school or whatever.
Yeah,
it's like,
right.
Have sex now so that it you can get good at it and then it whatever. But it's like that's just not how it works.
If you're not feeling horny, you don't need to do anything.
No.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I could talk to you all day. You have to come on again.
I would love that. This is so much fun.
Like, because I'm not kidding. We could go down. We just scratched the surface today.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
The best ever. No, you actually have to come on again.
I would love that. Okay, great. Yeah.
So that was me chatting with Emma Chamberlain for her podcast, Anything Goes. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, let us know. We're on Instagram, science_VS. I'm on TikTok @WendyZuckerman. Come say hello. We'll be back next week with regular Science Verses. I'm Wendy Zuckerman. Back to you next time.